I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. First, an interview we recorded a few weeks ago with Susan Senator, author of Autism Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 68 children is identified with autism spectrum disorder. ASD and autism are general terms for a group of complex disorders of brain development, which are characterized in varying degrees by difficulties in social interaction, verbal and nonverbal communication, and repetitive behaviors. It occurs in all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. Bear with us as I had a terrible cold when we did this interview. I asked Susan Senator to tell us about her son, Nat.
My son, Nat, is 26, and he's fairly severely impacted by autism. And by that, I mean he needs certain supports and structure in order to be successful in most of his daily living tasks. He has some language, understands more than he can get out, but he's able to live semi-independently. So it, as you pointed out just before, it's always different, you know. Yeah. The skills are and the deficits are kind of balanced differently. Mm.
And this book is about your journey, you and your family and Nat. It's personal, so it kind of reads like part memoir. And I think that's one of the things I like about your writing. You also wrote a book, Making Peace with Autism. And you know, a lot of people know I have a daughter with developmental disabilities. She's not autism, but I got a lot out of that myself just because some of these disorders are very similar. But I think that personal journey is, it speaks to families who have kids with disabilities.
Thank you. Yeah, that's my favorite kind of writing. I'm most at home writing about Nat and my other sons and our lives. And I feel like that is one of the best ways to connect with a reader who might not know anything about autism, just to kind of talk to them about what happens to us and to Nat.
Now, you start the book, biggest fear most parents of a child with any kind of severe disability is what happens when I die?
Right. Well, that is one of the main reasons I wrote the book, and I wanted to find the answer. And I'll tell you right now, I did not. And I still feel, though, it's going to be a fear, but it doesn't have to be something that keeps you from living a full life and from your autistic loved one living a full life. But it definitely requires forethought and planning.
Right. People are particular about the terminology. And you write, you will find in reading this book that I interchange the terms people with autism with autistic people. So tell us why.
Because as I'm sure you know, there's the people first movement that came about, I don't know, maybe the last 10 to 20 years, where you have people who don't want to be defined by their disability. So they want to be called something like a person with cerebral palsy or with Down syndrome, that kind of thing. And but somehow it seems to be a bit different in the autism community. I've talked to a lot of adults with autism who have verbal speech or who can type, and they want to be defined. They consider their autism a real part of who they are, and they're proud of it. So I was taking both sides into account, trying to respect both sides, and so I used them both.
Yeah, depending on who you were talking to, how they identified. Yeah,
right. I mean, I had people, actual interviewees, write into me after they read what I'd written about them and requested that I change things to people with disabilities. And of course I did that.
Yeah. So turning 22 is a big deal. It's the age children with autism and others who have an IEP, individual education plan, they're considered adults. It means they lose the programs and services they were receiving in school. And if you don't plan ahead, this can be a devastating time.
Right. It turning 22 can be, and most of the time is, a worrisome time, at least for autism families, because you don't really know what to ask for when you're transitioning out of the school system. You don't know what you should be planning for even before you age out, and nobody really tells you. The powers that be, it's not out of malice or anything. It's just, you know, with bureaucracy, you don't often have these different governmental agencies just kind of talking to each other. And they should, because the school system needs to be able to hook into the Department of Developmental Services to really be able to help the individual with what now they need to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting. My daughter's about the same age as Nat, and we were very lucky because I was thinking, 22, she's got all this time. And when she was in high school, it was her sped teacher who said, no, you need to get moving on this now. So we had a little bit opposite experience where you went when Nat was 17, and they said, oh, you have plenty of time.
Right. They said I had plenty of time or actually didn't even know what to tell me. So I kept worrying and obsessing, and what I did with that was to go to conferences or workshops whenever I could, whenever I heard of them, and really tried to just master that learning curve, at least the jargon, first of all the names of the programs and things like that, and get Nat on all the waiting lists that I could. And then just kind of still plan for the worst case scenario. How will he live away from us? How might we be able to afford staff? How will he work? And at least we did have a great liaison from the DDS who instructed our team in trying to get Nat to work as many hours in a row as possible so that we could establish the case that he was a good worker and needed to have employment as an adult.
Right. Now, the more independent you can help your child become, the better. And this doesn't start at 22.
Right. Independence is a huge thing. And I interviewed some people in the book who actually worked on that beforehand and made some really good strides with their child in terms of setting them up for adulthood. And we did that too. We, almost at age 16 or even younger, we focused a lot on how Nat could care for himself and how he could articulate a need and without waiting to be prompted. It's still a challenge, actually, but he learned somewhat how to advocate for himself to the degree that he could.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about housing options, because this, I think this is really confusing for a lot of people. How you determined what would be best for Nat, especially for a child who's nonverbal. You know what you want for your child, but sometimes it's hard to figure out what your child wants.
It's very hard to figure out about housing and what they might want, but it's just so key because it really is their life that we're talking about. And so I found that parents who listened in and really thought about their child and what they liked to do each day, were they out in the community? Did they like to go on walks? Did they like to be in the car? Even things like that, to figure out what the kind of living situation, what the best one would be. And we did that with Nat. I tried to think about, when is he happiest? Well, he's happiest when he's walking in the city, taking the T into Boston with my husband, picking whatever route he wants, and really getting to know the streets. So it was very important that he be in a semi-urban location. Right. That's just one example of what we had to think about for planning this. And he likes to be with people his own age, but not necessarily to talk to them. So having fairly nonverbal roommates might be the best thing for him.
Right. One of the things, the way they categorize Nat was, as you say, priority one, good news and bad news. So tell us why priority one is good and bad.
Priority one means that he qualifies for probably the highest category of funding, residential staffing support, and also day program in his case. That's the good news. You qualify for all that. But the bad news is, well, you're a very challenged person, and that's why you qualify for that. So hopefully you get what you need.
And funding is tough to come by. Waiting lists are long. I thought it was interesting. I think everybody's heard of Section 8, but I didn't know about project-based Section 8. Tell us about that.
A lot of people don't know about project-based Section 8 because I think it differs from town to town. In our case, I had heard that our town was interested in giving out waivers for people to create housing in particular houses. There was a lot of real estate around to buy up. It's just the problem is it's very expensive in my town. But if you could do that, if you could partner with an organization to buy a house and set it up for a group home, perhaps, you could possibly go for a Section 8 that's based on that home and stays with that home, not with the people in it. And that makes it so that you can apply for that particular home, that project, and get the reduced rate rent.
Now, you mentioned that Nat likes to be with people his own age, and he started in a group home. And I think, you know, a lot of times in a group home, when you're on a waiting list, somebody dies by the time, you know, you can get in there. And so they may be older adults. But you knew that this self-determination and person-centered planning, which enabled you to get Nat into a home that was more suitable to his needs. So tell us a little bit about that.
I found out from a friend and mentor early on that there really is a lot more flexibility for families in terms of figuring out what the housing situation should be like. And people often think they're under the misconception that they just have to take whatever slot comes up. So they might be offered a slot, you know, in some other town that and go and visit and see that all of the residents are much older and feel you might come away from that feeling depressed and feeling like your child's going to have kind of a lesser life without the right kind of peers. But families can actually try to come together with other families and try to come up with a group home community themselves and bring that plan to their state agency and try to work together on possibly even creating a new group home.
Employment and job training are key. You start that chapter with a quote from Temple Grandin. Start work skills at age 12. Run the church website. Work in a farmer's market. Let's not get trapped in the autism silo. It's a big spectrum. What would have happened to Einstein and Jobs if they'd had the autism label? Good question.
In classic Temple Grandin bluntness, and she's absolutely right. There are so many ways a person can get work experience, and you just have to think that way. You have to have your eyes open for any possible job or volunteer programs, anything where you find the right kind of employer, the right kind of people who work there. You're looking for someone who's just going to watch out for your guy and give him or her support, so that they can make it work. And in some ways, it's not magic. It's not rocket science. It's people deciding that they want to have this person working with them and accommodating them and being accepting.
Even those who test really low on cognitive skills, you write, quote, if you can get them a job, get them out there, their cognitive abilities improve.
I did hear this. I saw that there was research done in this. I believe it was Lynn Kearns Kergel out in UC Santa Barbara might have been the one who said that to me. And she's a researcher and an educator in autism. And I certainly believe it, that this, the more expectations you have on a person and the more adequate support they get, the better they'll do. I've seen it with my own son. I've seen it with people with autism who are even more complicated and challenging.
We're talking with Susan Senator, author of Autism Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Susan Senator, author of Autism Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. It can be so overwhelming. So let's share some opportunities that families created themselves. It's really interesting, some of the things that families can do for their family members who have autism. The Teaching Hotel. Tell us about the Teaching Hotel.
The Teaching Hotel is a great innovation. It's right out in Muncie, Indiana. And this dad basically came up with the idea of partnering with with Marriott and their ARC. The ARCs are all over the place, and these are support groups and organizations for people with developmental disabilities. So Jeff, this guy, this dad, partnered with the ARC and with Marriott to come up with and develop an old hotel site and build a hotel that would be a win-win situation where the Marriott would get these great employees who'd been trained over time to work exactly in the way that they want their workers to be. And they would train people with intellectual disabilities to do this job. So they had built in employees from a trainee program that began, it possibly, I think, begins in high school. I'm not sure exactly, but I know that towards transition, towards 22 or maybe at 22, you can apply for this trainee program at the Marriott, at the teaching hotel, and learn the hotel business.
Rising Tide Car Wash.
Rising Tide was another one of these innovative and just incredible businesses where a father and a brother wanted to create something for their loved one, and they researched different industries that are real fixtures of the community, and they figured on car wash. Being down there in Florida, I guess there was a lot of demand for your car to look great and not a ton of rain, so it's a good place to have a car wash. And they committed to training people with autism to run the whole show. Mm-hmm. And they, several years later, they're still doing it, and I believe they are franchising it. Right. At this point,
you write, Tom discovered two things. First, people with autism are indeed good at routine work, and if you structure things, they could be superior employees. Second was that businesses are not set up with features necessary to employ people with autism.
Right. The problem is that businesses don't necessarily think in terms of accommodating unusual employees. They have misconceptions about people with autism. They might think that, oh, there's going to be terrible disruptive behaviors, or oh, these guys don't want to talk to anyone. But it's really often not the case, especially if you do set up systems that work, rigid structures, simple direct explanations, even things like showing the person where the bathroom is and making sure they know so that they can just go and do that themselves and not become anxious. There's definite and simple ways to set up a business so that someone there with a disability can function beautifully. And with that, you end up getting a person who's very committed to work, who, like my son, does not need a day off, wouldn't even think to take time off if he has a cold. They really want to work. Yeah. It's the beauty of the focus that's built into autism.
Yeah, it's another area that's really difficult, I think, for a lot of families is finding caregivers.
Yes, I have a chapter on finding caregivers in the book because I know that is one of the biggest concerns, and anyone can imagine, how do you get somebody who's qualified and who's really going to be good with your loved one. So I first went to the source. I went to our caregiver and asked him how he learned to be the way he is and what he thinks people should look for and where he first made himself available. I think he actually came from Craigslist, but through a series of interviews, we determined that he was going to be just the right one. And he's still, 4 years later, he's still with my son. So people have to kind of look around for someone in their community who might actually end up being a good caregiver. There might be a neighbor that your loved one could move in with. There might be a person, a college student, who's trying to train in that kind of work. There could be someone on Craigslist. It's a matter of really thoroughly checking them out and really getting them to know each other and connect and see if that works.
The other thing is advocating. And one of the best ways, I think, to learn a lot, because it's overwhelming, you know, as we know, but support from other parents is important. But you have to learn to become an advocate, because otherwise your child may not be getting the best. And this is from school up to adulthood. You have to know what their rights are, and you have to know what's out there for them. And that's a big job.
Yeah, it's a lot to learn what's available and how to go for it, and where the funding stream is coming from, all that kind of stuff. But it is possible. My advice is for parents to go about this as slowly as they can, even though you're starting ahead of time, like at age 16 or even 14. Go to one workshop a year at that point. Give yourself time to process all the information. Ask people, look for a mentor and buy them coffee and sit down and ask all the questions you need. But really give yourself the time to learn it all. The more you know going into 22, of course, the better off you're going to be, because you're going to know what to ask for at those meetings.
Right. Talk about Facebook and your son's interaction with Facebook.
Facebook was an amazing thing for our family to figure out. I'm not sure even how it started, but my son is always interested in photos of loved ones, and with Facebook it was no different. He would be sitting near me and he'd be watching whatever I'd be doing on Facebook, and eventually it occurred to me that, hey, I could get him an account and I would control who friended him, because I really, you know, you can't trust everyone out there.
Right.
And basically it worked, because it gave Nat the time he needed to process a question. So if he was messaging with someone, they would ask him something, and then he could stop. He could read it, stop, and think. I could read it again for him, and he'd answer out loud, and then I could say, okay, type that. And it's so much easier for him than actually talking.
Yeah. What about relationships? This is a question you think, okay, you just kind of come to this, especially with severe disabilities, my son or daughter is probably never going to get married, never have a serious relationship. But that's not necessarily so.
It's not. You really can't think in terms of it's never going to happen, because there are so many cases of people who for whom that is just proven false every time. And I talked to at least two. I talked about something like three or four. They didn't all get in the book, but different autistic adults who indeed were married and were making it work, and they had their ups and downs and their issues. Other family members who bothered them, you know, didn't support them or whatever, just like anybody. Yeah. And it was working out for them. And even if one woman doesn't even live with her husband, but still they're married. People just figure out what they need to be happy, and the happy ones go and do that.
Yeah. You have a great little scene in the book where you're on the train and Nat sees a girl, but his going back to that focus, he clearly was smitten with this woman who he never really actually got to meet, but I guess he sat next to her.
Right, he was sitting next to her on the train, and I noticed that she had noticed him. And so I could watch from a few feet away what was going to happen. And I thought, oh, well, Nat's probably going to start sucking his thumb or talking to himself. And then she'll figure out that he's probably not for him, not for her. And watching, I saw my son really kind of pull himself together and not do any of those usual stereotypical behaviors, and he just kind of sat there like a guy, and it really felt to me like a moment for the two of them, and that it could have become something if it had been a different circumstance in a different place and more time. But it gave me so much hope.
Yeah. Talk about siblings.
Nat has two brothers who are younger, and a lot of the people I talked to also have siblings, and they're the kind of unsung hero in the families, because in fact the siblings will end up spending more time being caregivers in the course of a lifetime than even the parents, because they grow up with the sibling, and then they often end up being a caregiver in some degree. So I wanted to interview people who were both making it work and people who were struggling with it. And I discovered a lot of things, like it's better as a parent to try to talk about it early on, the idea that that you're going to need to be in your sibling's life in some way. But hopefully it'll be more your choice if the parent plans adequately and talks to the sibling about what they want to do. So I even found siblings who were in their 60s and now had guardianship of their autistic sibling who'd recently come out of an institution, and what that was like. Yeah. And there's a lot of growth.
Yeah. Ben, your youngest, talks about he has was diagnosed with a form of PTSD, and he talks about his anger that he had with his brother Nat, but it grew into this unconditional love. And that's got to be difficult for families when you're, as you know, as a parent, where you're struggling, you know, a lot of attention is going to your autistic child, but the other children are also impacted by this.
It's true. And in all the books that I've written about autism, there's this question of how much do you, for lack of a better word, force a relationship or strongly encourage a relationship that's going to be extremely difficult, probably for both parties, and to what degree do you let it evolve? And in our case, we let it evolve. And sometimes I feel like I wish I had done more actively, because my other two sons don't think to ask Nat to go to a movie with them. It's too hard. But what I've seen is that there are signs of growth in them, that where they smile at things that Nat says, they understand what he wants, they help him. So I see it's going to grow. And I think that hopefully what we did was right. Other families and other professionals really recommend trying to talk about it early on, not forcing, but talking about it.
Right. And, you know, there's this a guilt that goes along with this. And I'm thinking back to your last book, when the first time your family takes a vacation without Nat, but you come to this realization of, but Nat's happy in his vacation and we're happy in ours. And that's a really hard thing, I think, for some families to be able to separate. You know what I mean?
Right. It's vacations are tough because, of course, you want the whole family to be there and enjoy it. But it's just going to, it might make it harder. And if the possibility exists to focus on maybe your marriage or on your other children, then you should probably take that chance, take that opportunity. And the way I made myself feel okay about it was I made sure that Nat for that week was going to be doing something fun too.
Right. Talk about resources. You have all kinds of resources throughout the book.
There are resources in terms of funding streams. There's certain entitlements. There's certain money that you can get through Medicaid and through Social Security. People need to be aware of those federal programs. Each state is different. So sometimes the resources that you find are resources that might be built into your community, just naturally occurring supports, like I described before, on the job, perhaps, or a neighbor who gets it, who understands and helps. A local company that might want to take your guy under his wing. There's church groups that help as resources. So you have to be looking around to find these kindred spirits. And even other parents with autistic children, you might be able to find them at a Special Olympics game. You know, the parents talking on the sidelines are wonderful resources. They're your community. They are going to be your in-laws, basically, yeah, if your children can live together.
Susan Senator is the author of Autism, Adulthood Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. Susan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
Also, thanks to Doug Shugarts and Tom Devlin for production assistance in Boston.
Coming up after a break, are children with behavioral issues being too quickly diagnosed and medicated? A pediatrician offers her perspective.